2019 album, AM. That is Arctic Monkeys' Do I Wanna Know. It's cruising the decades, 100 years of music, and now we'll drop you off present day with a 2024 release from the Mavericks. And this is a recent duet featuring Nicole Atkins. It's called Live Close By, Visit Often on Cruising the Decades. Like a pretty good arrangement to me. Live Close By, Visit Often, the Mavericks 2024, Cruising the Decades from Moon and Stars, the band's 13th studio album. They were formed in Miami around 1990. And now we've done 100 years of music. Find out more at cruisingthedecades.com.
Over 100 years of music history. In the course of just 1 hour, you've been listening to Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. This is the global edition produced for shortwave, FM, and AM stations worldwide on the leading independent community and music radio stations on the planet. This program originates at WAPS-FM, The Summit, in Akron, Ohio, USA. For correspondence or QSL, contact Brad@thesummit.fm. Thank you for supporting independent, eclectic radio broadcasting and signals over the air from all corners of planet Earth. One broadcast to an audience of many, simultaneously. A shared listening experience. Radio and 100 years of music. Join us next time for the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Welcome, everybody. The understandable frustrations of Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin came to an explosive head yesterday when he confronted James Comer, the Republican chair of the House Oversight Committee, and said, "Are you guys going to impeach this guy being Joe Biden? What's the high crime and misdemeanor? Tell me exactly if any of the things you're alleging are true. Why haven't you impeached the guy?" This is extraordinarily interesting video. We're going to look at it here. And the primary question that I would keep in mind as we review this is, how long is long enough to figure out what Biden actually did wrong, as opposed to dancing around it with hyperbole and conjecture? Let's take a look at this first moment where Jamie Raskin just says, what's the crime? What is the crime?
Number two, I would like my time restored. And number three,
you have
not identified a single crime. Now. Well, what is the crime that you want to impeach Joe Biden for and keep this nonsense going? Well, why? What is the crime? Tell America right now.
You're about to find out.
Name
very
it.
Soon. Chair down,
very, very soon. This is starting to sound like when Trump told us in August of 2020, we were only 2 weeks away from his completely new health care plan replacing Obamacare being signed into law, despite the fact that he hadn't yet announced it. So what I'm hearing from James Comer is that they are getting really super dangerously very close to preparing for the final stage of announcing the home stretch as we work towards a potential declaration of what the crime could potentially maybe sort of be. And if that doesn't titillate and excite you, I don't know what does. We've been waiting for years at this point. Now, at another moment during the hearing, Comer brings up that Joe Biden was supposedly bribed with $9 million. And Jamie Raskin asks a really great question, which is, if that happened, then why don't you impeach him for it?
So it's okay. It's okay for, as Tony Bobulinski said, for China to bribe Joe Biden's family with $9 million.
But that's the lie that's been discredited. I mean, where is your impeachment investigation? If Joe Biden took a $9 million bribe from China, why aren't you impeaching him for that?
Well, who says we're not?
Well, I can invite Mr. Moskowitz to come back in. Do you want him?
I can tell you who says that they're not impeaching him: James Comer. This is all a charade, folks. Remember that we looked 2-3 weeks ago in James Comer's own fundraising emails. He's already saying we're not going to impeach. We're instead going to look at doing criminal referrals of Joe Biden to the Justice Department. He still doesn't tell us what the crimes are, but he's already acknowledging in fundraising emails the impeachment is going nowhere. He has already moved on from impeachment and is telling his supporters, we're not going to be able to get an impeachment here because Democrats wouldn't vote to convict anyway. Instead, we're focusing on criminal referrals. Jamie Raskin brings up that endless money has been spent on this. What about the fiscal responsibility? And James Comer goes, no, we really haven't spent much on this.
Office Mr. Building. Chairman.
What business? Did they have an interview?
Mr. Chairman, we have spent tens of millions of dollars Joe Biden, and you have not identified
a
single crime.
You are
really?
Lying.
Really?
That's a lie. We have not spent $10 million.
Hey, how much have you spent?
We haven't spent hardly anything.
Oh, it's been for free. Okay. All right. Well, in any event, you know what? Then we get what we paid for, because you got nothing.
It is absolutely true that, listen, if you spent a bunch of money, you've found nothing. And if you haven't spent a bunch of money, you've gotten what you've paid for, and that you've also found nothing. And this continued. And Jamie Raskin, at every opportunity, exposing this vapid and pointless fiasco for what it is, and Comer increasingly upset. It's not as easy when you try to do this stuff sitting next to Jamie Raskin as it is when you're on Fox News with Maria Bartiromo. That we're very quickly figuring out.
I don't know what business were they in. Well, what Biden, what business is the Comers well, in? You're talking about lots of people. There's lots of people in the family.
I'm a farmer. Your impeachment, I have land. I
your impeachment
land.
Investigation must identify a high
Bidens
crime
do?
And misdemeanor.
What did they do?
I'll tell you what Joe Biden did. He was a senator of the United States. Then he wrote a book, and he said he made the most money ever made in his life, millions of dollars on his book, and he gave $1 million.
That's what his family did. That's why Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Romania, China, Russia, that's why they paid the Biden family money because of Joe Biden.
None of those governments paid anyone any money.
Somebody needs therapy here, but it's nobody on our side of the aisle.
And then he starts slamming the gavel.
Okay,
the mention of therapy made him start banging his hammer. These are pathetic people, and these are very much not serious people. They all know this is going nowhere. This has a number of purposes. Number one, they've accomplished nothing, and they bring nothing to the table. So they're trying to play serious investigators, trying to prevent government corruption from stealing your dollars or whatever. And that's Joe Biden allegedly getting money from places he's never gotten money. So this is a way that they counteract the fact that they've done absolutely nothing. Number two, this is in service to Donald Trump. They realize Trump lost in 2020, and he lost significantly in the electoral vote and the popular vote. Now, of course, because of the way this works, it came down to 102,000 votes in three states. But they recognize the starting point is that 2024 is a rematch of a race that Trump lost in 2020. Since then, Trump's approval has come down. He's been charged with 91 felony counts in four criminal indictments. He's been found civilly liable for rape. It's not great when you start with having lost 4 years ago and now it's the same race being run back with the same candidate. So this is also in service to Trump. If we can find something or at least make it seem like we're getting close to potentially finding a piece of something when it comes to Joe Biden, they try to even the playing field when it comes to Trump and Biden, even though you really can't do it when you look at the facts. And number three, there is an egocentric element to this as well, where people like James Comer, who insists he's not looking for attention, is regularly holding hearings that go nowhere and appearing on Fox News and Newsmax and who knows wherever else, making the same vague, unsubstantiated proclamations in order to get attention and to make it appear as though he is doing something to make himself worthy of re-election in November. Because remember, every member of the House is up every 2 years. I believe James Comer's seat is almost certainly safe, but also there's a personal stake that he has in this. So nice job by Jamie Raskin. There's, you know, another month has gone by and they still have no specific high crime, misdemeanor or criminal act that they can point to. Charlie Kirk, a MAGA operative known for trying to indoctrinate the youth into MAGA-potamian thinking, is acknowledging they are getting crushed in the ground game. Joe Biden is opening offices and hiring people, whereas Donald Trump is laying off staffers and closing down offices. He is not telling us something we didn't know, but the fact that he's willing to acknowledge it publicly is still notable. So here's Charlie Kirk on the Charlie Kirk Show on Real America's Voice, where this airs. It's still a mystery to me. I've been looking under my furniture to see, is this where it airs? I don't know where it airs, but it's the Charlie Kirk Show on Real America's Voice. Here he is saying there is a major problem here with the ground game in this campaign.
We are struggling right now as a movement to open up the necessary field offices to compete against Joe Biden. We had Citizen Kane on here, and this is, you know, the Trump campaign is working really hard to fix Rana's mistake. Susie Wiles, Chris LaSavita, they're doing a great job of trying to fix what Rana left them. But here are the numbers, and the numbers are worth reporting. In the state of Georgia, Joe Biden has 14 field offices. In the state of Pennsylvania, Joe Biden has 14 field offices. In the state of Michigan, Joe Biden has 20 field offices. In the state of Wisconsin, Joe Biden has 44 field offices. In the state of Arizona, Joe Biden has 8 field offices. In Nevada, Joe Biden has 2 field offices. Between all of them, Joe Biden has 450 full-time people on staff in 9 states, and all 9 out of 9 swing state directors. Now, based on all of our data, we do not believe Donald Trump has a single field office in any one of those states yet open. I'm sure they're trying to fix that. And he has 5 staffers. So Joe Biden has 450 people. We have 5, and 2 out of 9 of the swing state directors have been hired. Now, thankfully, we at Turning Point Action, we have well over 100 people now chasing ballots in Arizona trying to close that gap, And that does not count Joe Biden's advertising advantage. It does not count his ability to control the mainstream media. I said this and people laughed. I said 6 months ago, Joe Biden is a formidable candidate, and people laughed. I said it's because of the infrastructure around him.
All right. So there's certainly the possibility that Charlie Kirk is overplaying the disadvantage at which the Trump campaign finds itself in order to motivate people. It's logical to be cynical when it comes to someone like Charlie Kirk, but there is a lot of controversy about all aspects of this. Now, one of the reasons that we believe a lot of the field office numbers are zero for Trump is that when Lara Trump became co-chair of the Republican National Committee, when she became co-chair of the RNC, she reportedly closed a bunch of these field offices, saying they don't believe they need them. Donald Trump doesn't believe they need them. However, that's since been denied. So honestly, I don't know the truth of why the numbers are allegedly zero field offices in some of these places, but a lot of this does have to do with fundraising or lack thereof. We know that when we look at cash on hand numbers, they are way better for President Biden than they are for Trump. We know that Trump has significant expenses when it comes to legal fees and all of the stuff that he's embroiled in right now. So all of this is to say nothing other than the level of organization for Biden seems to be orders of magnitude better than the level of organization for Trump. But we should never understate the potential enthusiasm gap, which could exist. The enthusiasm gap might favor Biden, because I'll give you an example. I don't go around putting Biden stickers on my car. I don't put a Biden flag on the boat that I don't have or any of this stuff. But I am absolutely committed to voting in November to prevent 4 more years of Trump and to give Joe Biden another 4 years to try to continue the good record with the economy that he has built. So I may not be rah-rah cult-like commitment guy the way a lot of these Trump people are, but I am very committed to doing everything I can to make sure Biden gets reelected and Trump doesn't. We don't know exactly the way the enthusiasm gap is going to go, but if fundraising is a proxy to enthusiasm, that does not look good for Trump. And if door knocking and field offices are a proxy to engagement for the Trump campaign, that's also not looking particularly good. So they know they're potentially in trouble. All of it doesn't matter if we don't get out and vote. And that's exactly what we should plan to do. Right wing ghouls in Arizona cheered yesterday for blocking even debate on maybe doing something about this antiquated, absolutely draconian, do I dare say dark ages? Are we still allowed to say dark ages? Abortion law in Arizona that dates back to 1864. Here is video of these ghouls aroused and titillated by denying even a conversation about whether a law from 1864 is well suited to 2024. There they are cheering that there isn't even going to be a conversation about what to do about this 1864 law, if anything. They need to be punished in November at the ballot box. And I'm going to talk about those numbers in a moment. But we have some of the information on this. Axios reports Arizona House again blocks repeal of 1864 abortion ban. Senate leaves the door open. The Arizona Senate took a concrete step towards repealing the pre-Roe abortion ban. But House Republicans continue to block similar efforts, leaving the fate of the 1864 law in question. Razor thin margins, 30-30 in the House, 16-14 in the Senate. illustrate the tensions that have resurfaced over the issue since the Arizona Supreme Court reinstated the pre-Roe ban last week. Three Republicans in competitive districts joined Democrats to support repeal. Attention goes back to the House, where the Republican speaker has vowed to continue to stymie the effort. I want to remind you about the numbers in Arizona in 2020. In the presidential election in Arizona, Joe Biden won 49.4% to 49%. Arizona came down to 10,457 votes. I need 10,457 votes. Give me a break. That is an extraordinarily small margin. We have to blow them out in November, and they need to be punished electorally for this. Now, I want to be crystal clear. I am not even pretending to allude to any kind of physical punishment. OK, I know that there are going to be 1 out of 1,000 people who watch this who are going to say, David, aren't you advocating for violence? No, I'm advocating for an electoral blowout in November. That's what they deserve. Now, if you want to talk about physical injury and pain, what this 1864 law will impose on Arizona women does actually include the real possibility of physical harm. It does do that. And we need to make sure that, I mean, listen, more people today than at any point in the Roe v. Wade era in the United States believe abortion should be legal in most circumstances. That's not what the Arizona law says. The Arizona law says something very different. It doesn't even include exceptions for rape and for incest, although it does carve out a potential exception for the health of the mother in certain situations, if it can be demonstrated to the satisfaction of, I guess, whoever was making the law in 1864, right? And we know who that was. So we do need to ensure that they are punished here. We have seen small punishments come in ballot referenda since the repeal of Roe v. Wade. We saw some of those results in the special or off-year elections of 2023. But this is absolutely imperative. And listen, hopefully it makes it so that this is not the razor's thin election that we saw in 2020 in the sense of 100,000 or so votes in three states being the determining factor in Joe Biden's victory. In the meantime, Republicans have no idea what to do except to talk about impeaching people. They impeach Mayorkas and it's already over. Let's talk about that next. This may be the most short-lived impeachment in American history. Republicans impeached Joe Biden's Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. They very somberly delivered the articles of impeachment to the Senate a couple of days ago. We talked about it yesterday. And just like that, the impeachment is over. The New York Times reports Senate dismisses impeachment charges against Mayorkas without a trial. Democrats quickly swept aside the articles of impeachment, accusing the Homeland Security of refusing to enforce immigration laws and breach of public trust, calling them unconstitutional. Here is the moment in the Senate where this took place. All Democrats voted in favor of dismissing this. I believe all but one Republican voted against, and there was one Republican, I forget who it was, maybe Lisa Murkowski, who voted present.
On this vote, Senate will be in order. On this vote, the yeas are 51, the nays are 49. The point of order is well taken. Article 2 falls.
Okay. So based on that, I guess there were no present votes. Maybe there was initially a present vote. I read that, but 51-49, party line vote. The impeachment of Mayorkas is over. Now, you might be saying, well, why not go to the trial? Why not do the entire thing? This is so without merit. This is so empty and devoid of any substance that I appreciate Democrats in the Senate saying we are not going to waste taxpayer money. We are not going to waste Senate time. We are not going to, I don't even know if it would have been covered, honestly, by corporate media, but we are going to save corporate media the distraction of covering an impeachment trial destined to go nowhere because there is nothing to it. It's sort of like when you pour water on cotton candy and next thing you know, it's gone. It's gone. I appreciate that they are doing this. We all know this was going nowhere, and it is yet another failure of the Republican Party. What are they going to say to justify their reelections and elections in November? We know part of it used to be the economy is terrible and we will fix it. That's not flying anymore because everybody can tell the economy is not terrible and it doesn't exactly need fixing. It needs continued improvement. It needs tweaks. We need to do better. But the idea of a disastrous economy is nonsense. So instead, they started thinking of, well, what about Biden crimes, bribery? What other crimes can we get him for? Except their investigation of years has continued to find nothing. Well, what about the border? How about we impeach Mayorkas over the border? Except it's completely and totally bogus, and it has already fallen. So I don't know what they're going to say to justify their elections in November. Something about fighting communism and Marxism, which we struggle to actually find anywhere in the United States. But they deserve to lose, and hopefully this is the next failed attempt at trying to justify their elections. I have a challenge for you today. I dare you to make sense out of this new conspiracy theory from Republican Congressman Greg Murphy from North Carolina. Greg Murphy appeared on Newsmax, and he has a new conspiracy theory so complicated and convoluted and absurd. I dare you to understand it. Now, I'm going to give you a hint before I play it. The gist of the theory, and again, this is like I barely understand it, but the gist of the theory is that Donald Trump's Secretary of the Army back in January of 2021, we're going back to the Trump riots, Trump's Secretary of the Army deliberately prevented the National Guard from providing security on the day of the Trump riots because he wanted chaos so that then Joe Biden would give him a job in his administration. Now, if he wanted a job in the Biden administration, why would he allow the certification of Biden's election to take place? It doesn't really make sense. My head's already spinning, but let's listen to this. And again, I challenge you to explain this conspiracy theory.
Now, whether it would change the outcome is really not really the discussion. The fact that the National Guard were ready, they were ready to act, and they were slow-walked by the Secretary of the Army, apparently with some thoughts that he was going to join the Biden administration. He was invited to come to the hearing today, but he declined, and he would have been under oath, and he would have had to ask some answer some very, very hard questions.
You said slow-walked it for say that last line again. I'm sorry.
Even the Newsmax host is like, wait a second, who did what now?
About joining the Biden administration?
Yeah, he tried to slow walk it. The thoughts are that he possibly wanted to pursue a position in the Biden administration. I don't have firsthand knowledge of that. But
that's the key line, by the way. I don't have firsthand knowledge of that. We could end this entire thing right here.
That's what one of the general working diagnoses is, as we say. The other thing is,
how would that get him a potential position within the Biden administration?
The Newsmax guy is not buying it. It's so stupid.
Go into that a little bit.
Well, it allows more and more time for the January 6th, riots or whatever we want to call them to occur, to really grow and to fulminate, rather than getting the National Guard there in time and stopping this. No, he slow walked it to allow more chaos to occur.
Huh.
I mean, that would certainly track.
I just don't really understand the motive. In other words, why is it that you're more likely to get hired by Biden if you allow riots that endanger his certification to be bigger and last any longer? It just doesn't. Maybe I just am not conspiratorially minded enough to understand this, but it's not really making any sense to me. And maybe if he had a whiteboard with pieces of string linking together different push pins or something like that, it would be clearer to me. But the key line here in this wild, wild conspiracy theory from Mike Murphy, Greg Murphy. The key line is, I don't have firsthand knowledge of this. And I think we can basically leave it there. Let's take a very quick break. We're going to hear from a sponsor briefly, unless you are listening to the members-only commercial-free version of the show. And we are going to hear in a moment from a former Trump supporter. This is going to be very interesting. Stand by. Today, we welcome to the program Nathan Price. Nathan is a Republican from Ohio, a former Trump voter who is no longer supporting Donald Trump in 2024. Very much looking forward to this discussion and learning a little something here. So, Nathan, I mean, give us the big picture. Has your identity as a voter since you started voting always been a Republican?
Yeah, I've actually never voted for a Democrat before. The only time, there was one time I voted for an independent candidate, but it was a personal family friend of ours. So that's like the only exception. Otherwise, I've always voted Republican since 2016 when I've been old enough to vote.
That was going to be my
2014.
Question. When were you first old enough to vote? So the first presidential election you voted in was 2016, and you voted for Trump both times. Is that right?
Yes.
What attracted you to Trump?
At first, I wasn't. Being from Ohio in 16, I really liked Kasich. He was our governor at the time. So obviously I voted for him in the primary.
Yep.
I didn't really like Trump actually for a while until the convention in 16 when he gave his speech. And I agreed with most of it. And I didn't agree with hardly anything that Hillary said. So I was like, all right, yeah, sure, I'll go with Trump. And then in 2020, it was pretty much the same thing.
When you say you agreed with most of it, it was not, especially in 2020, it was not a particularly policy heavy campaign that Trump ran.
It wasn't, and that's what bothered me.
So that started to bother you in 20, and did it bother you in 16?
No, I was actually really excited in 16. And you know, he followed through on some stuff. I really liked his foreign policy overall. Recently, his rhetoric's been a lot more isolationist, which I don't think is really safe for us. But in 20, yeah, I would agree. It wasn't really policy focused. I wished it had been. He probably would have done better had it been more policy focused. And then it was after the election, his rhetoric just was unhinged, and I couldn't support him after that.
Thinking about the things you say he followed through on in that first term that you liked, what would be on that list?
Well, the tax cuts, sort of. One of the big things that I really care about is fiscal conservatism and, you know, individual tax cuts for middle class. Now, he kind of did that, but they're set to expire next year. And that, and I don't like that because these corporate tax cuts were permanent.
Yes. Yet
the stuff for the working man and, you know, the middle class, those expire, which looking back, it was kind of a grift.
Well, so that's interesting. So you say you like some of the stuff he did at the time, but in retrospect, you're realizing it was not what it was chalked up to be necessarily.
And I was in college at the time. Now that I actually live and work in the quote unquote real world, my views have definitely been evolving rapidly the last few years.
Did you benefit from Trump's tax cut plan?
Yeah, because, you know, my husband and I were looking at what it'll look like once the tax cuts expire. It'll definitely increase what we would end up owing. But again, it's at the time I didn't benefit because I was in college.
Okay. You mentioned your husband. Now, there has been a lot of discussion as to whether the Republican Party in general has modernized on the issue of same-sex marriage or not. There has been a lot of discussion as to what Trump, quote, really believes versus the way that he is running. Now, I'm going to give you an example. Trump has run as an anti-abortion candidate. I don't believe he's anti-abortion. He was pro-choice until he was 68. His explanation for why he is now against abortion, I just don't believe. I think it's just he says what he needs to say to get Republicans to vote for him. What do you believe Trump genuinely believes about gay marriage and LGBT rights?
I genuinely believe that he is in support of it.
I kind of agree with you. And what's interesting about this is I'm not claiming that Trump is particularly enlightened on LGBTQ rights. I just think that much like the reason that he's been pro-choice his first 68 years of life, he grew up in an environment where in the same way that I think he harbors sort of stereotypical prejudicial beliefs about Jews while not being overtly anti-Semitic in the way some are. I think it's kind of the same with LGBT for Trump, but that he's been pushed into running a certain way. I have lots of criticisms of Trump, and that he enables a lot of this, the hate, I think is a criticism, but I'm kind of with you on what his personal beliefs are, to be honest.
Yeah. And it's an old episode. I don't know if it's from The Apprentice or what, but there's a quote where he said, you know, a contestant said that they were gay, and he's like, and you know, that's okay. He said something about like, if you go to it was making a comparison, basically, like you can like
to restaurants. It was like, you know, some people like pizza and some people like pasta or something like that.
That's
not the type of belief that changes at that late in life, is my opinion. That's why I ended up where you ended up on this.
Yes.
Did Trump's handling of COVID give you any pause in the sense of inject bleach, hydroxychloroquine, it'll be over by Easter of 2020? How did that play into your opinion?
Well, I'm a nurse, so it was, and I was finishing nursing school when all that started. I thought it was kind of, it was just frankly stupid for him to have said what he said. He should not have been saying things that he was not qualified to say. And if he was to say that, he should have been saying that with the doctors standing next to him agreeing that that's, you know, what you should or shouldn't do. There was no evidence that any of that was going to do anything. And what I also, here's what I really didn't like about the COVID stuff. A lot of people say now, oh, the Democrats shut down the whole country. No, Trump shut down the country. He stood up there on press conference and sent out mailers in March saying, everyone stay home for 2 weeks and it'll be over. He shut down the country. If people forget that, it was him that originally shut it down. And, there was, 20% unemployment for just that little blip in March and April. That was entirely him. And we have been trying to recover from that ever since.
I'm curious. You say in your video that we looked at on my program some time ago that you'll always be a Republican. But in a sense, the Republican Party for now seems to basically be Trump, or at least enough Trump to get him the nomination. How are you feeling about the party more broadly right now? Do you see a path to getting back to something beyond Trump?
Him losing, and the party realizing that it was a very big, there are plenty of other competent Republicans that could have been the presidential candidate. And unfortunately, and I don't blame the primary voters, because it's all Trump. He has this unique ability to con people into believing that he is a savior of some sort. Not one person is ever a savior like that. That's where you're not going to actually ever get whatever policy positions you want to accomplish, because you're beholden to just this one person for his, you know, success to be president. So I think that we could move on past him and actually get back to, now I wouldn't want to say get back to the quote unquote old Republican Party as well. I would like to, there's some policies that he brought in, such as stronger immigration reform, that I definitely still agree with. I don't want to go back to the more lackadaisical Republican views on immigration, the illegal immigration, I want to clarify. But I think it's going to take him having to lose big for Republicans to realize that this is something we can't continue to do, because we will continue to lose.
So one of the points that I made in looking at your video and others that former Trump voters have made explaining why they're no longer supporting Trump, one of the points I made is that you and some of the others have an ability for examining your previous beliefs, the humility to say, hey, I was wrong, or I was led the wrong way, sort of traits that are required in order to change your mind. And that's great, but you've already changed your mind. And the question is, what about the people that we see at the Trump rallies? What about the people that we see that see him as a godlike figure, et cetera? Do you interact with any of those sorts of folks in Ohio? And, you know, you campaigned for Trump and phone banked previously. There seems to be something very different about the way you're approaching this and the way that they are approaching it. And I don't think that they're necessarily reachable. I wonder if you think that those folks are reachable.
It's interesting. I've been to 5 Trump rallies in the past. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. I've never really actually thought about that. I don't really, you know, the family and friends that I have that are staunch Trump supporters, I'm not really trying to convince them to not vote for Trump, because I used to be there. So I understand where they are now. I think that, because I don't want to ever try to humiliate them, because then when you humiliate anyone, then they're going to dig in their heels even more on the positions.
Sure. An empathetic environment where they're comfortable changing their mind is what you want to generate.
Yes, and that's exactly why I am saying as much as I can, because it's a permission structure that someone who donated, campaigned, and stuck out my neck like I did for Trump all those years, and then if I was able to change my mind, it's okay if you want to change your mind too. You don't have to like Democrats or Joe Biden or anything, but you don't have to just go along with the other either.
I'm curious, when it comes to the staunch Trump supporters you mentioned, what's their reaction to learning you're no longer with Trump?
I've been told that I'm betraying my conservative principles. However, to me, the most conservative principle possible is preserving the institutions of our government, which Trump has very clearly stated that he has no intention of respecting. So I don't know how I could be any more conservative than by not voting for him and voting to destroy our institutions.
And when you look at Biden, even I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but if I understand what you're saying, you see someone with whom you disagree on many policies, but where the institutions and the structures of the country are not at risk. Is that right?
We can survive bad policy. The United States has a unique ability to survive bad policy, but we can't survive bad men. And I think that's the principle of any republic. You can survive bad policies, but not bad men. And I'm not willing to sacrifice, our constitutional republic for some vague promise of prosperity that Trump tries to make.
And that perspective is the one that some of the staunch Ohio Trump supporters who you talk to are saying is a betrayal.
Yes.
Wow. That's I don't even know where you enter the conversation, if that's where the starting point is.
Usually I just say, hey, let not now, we're at Easter, let's not have the conversation, or whatever it may be.
Have you been able to bring anyone out of the Trump cult?
My dad.
Really?
He kind of came on his own, but I consume news much more than he does. So yeah. I'll share with him things that I read or think about, and he'll be like, oh, I never thought of it that way. He's like, wow, it really was lousy what he did all those years.
Do you remember which specific things had the most impact on your dad? In other words, was it the Sharpie on the hurricane map versus inciting the riots versus whatever,
I think it's just that he voted for Rubio in the 16 primary. He never really liked Trump because he didn't feel like he had the discipline. And I think it was after he lost the election and him just complete there was some, I don't really, it's really weird. After he lost the election like that, there was something dark that happened with him and the people around him. Like, yeah, there were undisciplined and irresponsible times, but then something really changed after that, and it's never really gone back. So whatever that was that I saw, my dad kind of saw the same thing, and he's like, we can't go back to that. Like, he lost, he's a loser, I'm not gonna try again. It's like Brian Jennings, who lost three times in like the late 1800s. Like, you keep trying but they still lose. Like, why are we going to try again?
When you look at Biden, what do you think are the worst Biden policies?
His foreign policy.
Specifically with regard to which country or situation?
Well, I was actually telling this to my husband last night. He kind of gets it right, but he's always late to it. So he's getting Ukraine aid, but he gets the anti-tank guns to them 3 months after they asked for it. Ukraine asked for the fighter jets. He gives the fighter jets to them 3 months after they asked for it.
Now, Nathan, not to interrupt you, but doesn't a lot of that delay have to do with these Republicans in Congress where the purse strings are controlled, who are playing coy with not sending anything to Ukraine?
It does. But the war in Ukraine started in 22 when Democrats had control of the House and Senate. And Zelensky was asking for that stuff from the very beginning. So he had the ability to do it, but he didn't. Now, okay. I will agree with you that now Republicans are also stalling it, which I completely disagree with. And it's actually really funny. You got Republicans now that are like, we have to support Israel. And then they're at the same side of their mouth saying, oh, we don't need to support Ukraine. You can't pick and choose. It all is intertwined because China, Russia, Iran, all of this is related to each other.
Yes. So you don't like the you think Biden's doing the right things, but too slowly when it comes to Ukraine.
Ukraine, yes.
Okay. And then how about just one other Biden policy you don't like?
I don't think we should have left Afghanistan.
Really? So when Trump wanted to leave, you also didn't agree with leaving?
No.
What was the point of staying?
We had, what, 2,000 troops there? That little amount there was enough to keep the powder keg from unloading. Because ever since we left Afghanistan, look what's been happening in the Middle East. The quasi-war between Yemen and the Houthis and Saudi Arabia has gotten worse. We obviously see what's been happening between Gaza and Israel now. Iran directly attacked Israel, which never happened before for Iran to directly attack from their soil to Israel.
And you blame that on leaving Afghanistan?
Yes, because it opened a permission structure of American weakness that was unnecessary. And it was how we left too. How we left was extremely irresponsible. I think we could have left, but we left too quickly, because as we were preparing to leave, the Taliban was advancing closer and closer to Kabul throughout the summer of 21.
All right. Well, I mean, listen, we disagree on this, but I'm curious, are you saying just indefinite commitment of those 2,000 troops in Afghanistan? No. I mean, 20 years is a long time. There would really be no end in sight if we say just keep them there, right? And maybe that's okay with you.
When he took them out, when he did, was not the best time. Mm. Now, I get what you're saying. Maybe what I'm saying more than anything is I wish it could have been a perfect scenario where we could have kept it there without a problem. But I getting them out also was important, because you make a good point. We couldn't have stayed there for forever. But we were still on the process of leaving, knowing that the Taliban was advancing. And now that we've left, whatever we half accomplished in those 20 years we were there has been thrown away.
My question is,
it's exactly back to where we were with the Taliban in control.
My question is, how much did we really accomplish in the last 18 of those 20 years? And that's a question probably for a different day. We've been speaking with Nathan Price. Really appreciate you telling your story, and let's see if we can work together to prevent Trump from getting another 4 years in the fall. I appreciate you talking to me.
Whatever it takes. Thank you.
Let's do some legal discussion, if you can call it that. Donald Trump, confused and disoriented, was bemoaning on Truth Social that he can't just strike an unlimited number of jurors that he doesn't like for whatever reason from jury selection in his criminal trials. A reminder, the first of Donald Trump's four criminal trials started on Monday with jury selection. They were off yesterday. Jury selection resumes today. Reportedly, 7 of the 12 jurors have been seated. Now they need to select 5 additional jurors and some number of alternates. I believe it may even be up to 6 alternates, 12 and 6. And we will learn more about the outcome of that very, very soon. Now, we've already heard from some of the jurors that have been removed, including one young lady who was very much not a fan of Trump, but claimed that she could still be fair and objective. So Trump takes to Truth Social yesterday and he says, quote, "I thought strikes were supposed to be unlimited when we were picking our jury. I was then told we only had 10, not nearly enough when we were purposely given the second worst venue in the country. Don't worry. We have the first worst also." Some would just call it the worst, but I guess you could say the first worst. "As the witch hunt continues, election interference." So a couple different things. I assume by the worst venue, Trump means Washington, D.C., with the idea that Washington, D.C. is even more Democratic leaning than the New York City borough of Manhattan. Now, we've already talked about why the case is in Manhattan, and it's because that's where the alleged crimes took place. And that's where it was investigated. So it would be normal that that's where you would ultimately have the trial. Now, of course, even with Manhattan being left leaning, there are still more than enough non-political folks, centrists, right leaners, individuals who can be fair, that you can find 12 jurors and 6 alternates. But there's a couple different things here that are sort of disturbing about Trump's confusion. Number one, it would make no sense for strikes to be unlimited in any criminal case, because then you could just indefinitely delay the trial by striking jurors. Now, it's important to mention that there's a limited number of peremptory strikes, which it's just, we don't want this juror. We don't have to give a reason. This is somebody we don't want. There's a limited number. If you can make a good challenge for cause, in addition to the peremptory strikes, if you can say this individual simply cannot carry out their job fairly here, then that is a different case that you can make. And there's a bunch of strategy between jury selection. Many of the major trials bring in jury consultants who focus only on selecting jurors. And there is a question as to what does it mean to have a fair and appropriate jury? What is a jury of one's peers? Does Donald Trump even really have 12 peers plus six alternate peers anywhere? Never mind in Manhattan, given a lot of different things, including his role as former president of the United States. And you in an ideal world, you would be judged by a jury that is in some ways at least representative of a cross section of society. As we get those, there have been some early declarations and reporting about the makeup of this jury. But still, we don't know everything about it. I believe that I last heard there were two lawyers on the jury, for example. Many lawyers will say, I don't want lawyers on my juries, depending on the case and the facts. Sometimes lawyers will say it is actually to my advantage to have lawyers on the jury. So all of this stuff goes to strategy. But Trump's lawyers have known since the beginning that there would be 10 strikes. And Trump's seeming confusion about this raises questions about how much Trump understands about these proceedings, how much Trump's lawyers are telling Trump about the proceedings. And of course, even if Trump's lawyers are telling him about the proceedings, to what degree is Trump listening to or even understanding them? So Trump confused about jury selection. Now let's hear a little bit from Trump's failed former lawyer, Lina Haba, continuing to spread distortions about due process and venue and so many other things. Lina Haba is not exactly a lawyer's lawyer. I was recently at a legal conference in Las Vegas, and there were some attorneys there described as lawyer's lawyers who lawyer and try cases in a way that is interesting and impressive and to be studied by other lawyers. Lina Haba does not exactly meet that standard, that I can tell you. And now, as Donald Trump's former lawyer and his on-air and media spokesperson of sorts, she has been doing interview after interview to try to run PR interference for Trump during this jury selection process in his first of four criminal trials. She appeared on Newsmax yesterday, and she says that the reason that this trial is being held in New York is by design for political reasons. I have to assume she knows this isn't true, but let's listen to what she had to say.
We're in a blue state. That's all by design. Don't get it twisted, folks. They do this intentionally, just like they're bringing the one in Washington, just like Georgia. They pick these states on purpose.
Now, remember, Georgia is not exactly a ripping blue state. It is basically a 50-50 state, which Biden barely won by 11,000 votes in 2020. The reason that there is a trial in Georgia is that Trump is accused of crimes in Georgia. The reason that there is a trial in Washington, D.C. is that we are talking about federal crimes investigated in D.C. That's the venue. So that's where they're going to try the case. And the reason that there is a trial in New York is that that is where Trump and Michael Cohen concocted this scheme of alleged election interference with the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. It took place in New York. And so that's why the trial is being held there. Lina Haba also commenting again on reports that Donald Trump fell asleep in court.
Lina, Maggie Haberman was in the courtroom yesterday, and you know, a reporter from the New York Times, and she claims that Trump fell asleep. I mean, weigh in on this. Is she wrong? I mean, she very adamantly believes he fell asleep, and he says he didn't. What do you weigh in on this, please?
Having not been there, Alina, please give us your opinion.
He's not there. I find that a remarkable story at best. President Trump, you know, he reads a lot. I don't know what he was doing. I wasn't there. There are no.
She's already lying. Trump doesn't read. She doesn't really know what to say. But the idea that Trump reading a lot serves as some kind of pretext to argue that it's unlikely he fell asleep doesn't even make any passing sense.
Cameras, I wish there were, but he's been sitting there as he's forced to at the threat of going to jail if he's not sitting there for what I assume would be a very mundane day. They are going through jury selection.
Right.
There were a tremendous amount of motions being heard yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
But no, look, I wasn't there, so I can't comment on that. I find that to be a ridiculous thought, though.
So she wasn't there, so she can't say for sure. But it sounds unlikely Trump would sleep at trial because he reads a lot. It's not necessarily convincing me. And then lastly, again, another one of these non-legal arguments that you could never get away with in court. Alina Habba saying this trial doesn't even make sense because there was no murder here. We're talking about accounting elements.
There was no murder here. There was nothing. There right. was somebody in the accounting department at the Trump Organization, while the president was sitting in the Oval Office, that booked a legal issue as a legal issue in the accounting records. And now they're making a misdemeanor or felony. What is the rush?
Now, remember that if this can all be chalked up to a mistake, it would suggest it wasn't done deliberately, knowing exactly why this non-legal expense was booked as a legal expense. It was booked in this way to hide the fact that it was effectively a campaign contribution that was squirreled through Michael Cohen in order to prevent Stormy Daniels from talking and potentially messing up Trump's election to the presidency, which, by the way, if it hadn't happened, we would still have Roe v. Wade. None of these are legal arguments. It's there's a reason why they are being made on TV rather than in court. And failed former Trump lawyer Alina Habba showing us why she is a failed former lawyer. We have a voicemail line. You can call it any time of day. That number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here's a very, very good comment about modern conservatism. Take a listen.
Yes, David, notice you, like a lot of people, keep referring to the radical right as conservative. You know, the terms are mutually exclusive, I believe. These radicals cannot be conservative. You should stop calling them that. They're anything but. Thank you. Have a good day. This is James in Spokane, by the way.
This is a very good point. And just to be in a little bit of my defense, I actually don't remember continuing to call or calling the modern MAGA right conservative. I've pointed out there's really nothing conservative about them. But the point James makes is a very good one. You don't have to like actual conservatives or agree with actual conservatives to recognize that they are a very, very different thing politically than modern MAGA Trump Republicans. Think, for example, about all of the non-conservative aspects to MAGA Trumpism, a total disregard for democratic norms. That is something that historically conservatives actually supported. An open support for authoritarianism. There is a long history of American conservatism not supporting authoritarianism. They may support lots of stuff we disagree with, but not the overt dictatorial authoritarianism. Protectionism is something that traditional conservatism tended not to support. And the tariff and trade regulations of Trumpism are very much not conservative. The populist rhetoric that Trump and his acolytes have used to try to indoctrinate and sucker in cult members, not a normal feature of traditional conservatism. And then the extreme conspiracy theorizing. Yes, there have been some conspiracy theories among the more traditional American right wing over the last 50 years, and there have been some on the left. But the level of conspiracy theorizing that we currently see among the MAGA Trumpist right is not conservative. And then you can also say, well, what traditional conservative principles are missing from MAGA Trumpism? And there are many. I'm going to call it fiscal responsibility, so-called fiscal responsibility. I know that they often didn't adhere to it, but that the idea of even claiming to subscribe to fiscal conservatism is gone from MAGA Trumpism. A respect for the rule of law, period, not only when it's convenient, a conservative principle, whether they adhere to it is a different question, gone from MAGA Trumpism. Respect for traditional institutions, gone. Let's get rid of the FBI. Let's get rid of the IRS. Let's get rid of the Department of Education and Commerce and all of these things. No more respect for traditional institutions, and a respect for international alliances and keeping to our word, something that used to be a stated principle of conservatism, gone. Paris Climate Agreement, let's get out. The Iran nuclear deal, even though Iran has been abiding by it, let's get out. NATO, let's not do what we're supposed to be doing. Let's get out. Let's demand other things from people. That's gone. That conservative principle is completely and totally gone. So it's not about arguing that the previous conservatives were great. It's about recognizing that there is really nothing conservative left about what we are seeing right now from MAGA Trumpism. Excellent voicemail. All right. On the bonus show today, the Supreme Court has effectively abolished the right to mass protest in three states. I'll tell you which three states and we will discuss it. Number two, a number of Democratic Senate candidates are out fundraising their Republican opponents. It's not just Biden outraising Trump. It's happening down ballot. What does it portend for what's to take place in November? And the next level of deep fakes is now here. Real time deep fake romance scams are here. How to avoid falling for them. There's one surefire way, but we'll get to that. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money. Everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
I implore you to grab a membership at joinpacman.com. We're trying to grow our support from 0.5% to 1% of our audience. Help us get there. Sign up at joinpacman.com. Use the coupon code SAVEDEMOCRACY24 if you would like to.
Thank your lucky stars. Every day you're not Dave Pacman.
And take Alex Jones' advice. Thank your lucky stars every day you're not Dave Pacman. We'll see you on the bonus show. Elon Musk's Tesla expected to lay off more than 10% of its workforce. And everybody is seeing in this what they want to ascribe politically, either to Elon Musk or to electric vehicles. I think both interpretations are wrong here, and I want to discuss it. CNBC reporting, Dow surges more than 100 points as strong retail sales and earnings overshadow the Iran-Israel conflict. But one company that is not doing so well is Tesla. Tesla will lay off more than 10% of its global workforce. And it gives access, the article does, to an Elon Musk memo that refers to preparing the company for the next phase of growth, looking at cost reductions, increasing productivity. And indeed, there is going to be a more than 10% layoff of Tesla staff. Now, let me give you a couple different perspectives on this that are being floated, none of which I think really captures what's going on. And I say this, I'm going to give this disclaimer, even though people said I no longer have to because I no longer own the stock. Some people still think I do. I used to own Tesla stock. I sold all of it. Okay. I still drive a Tesla for a few more months, but then my lease is over and I'm getting almost certainly something different. So this has nothing to do with my personal connection to Tesla. And quite frankly, I had such a relatively small amount of stock anyway. It doesn't even really matter. There are some who really don't like Elon Musk and are saying this is what Elon Musk has caused. Elon Musk has ruined Tesla. It's terrible. He ruined it just like he ruined Twitter by turning it into X and all of the things that are going on. So the 10% layoff is simply because Elon Musk sucks. I don't think that's actually the situation in this particular case. The other side of this is because electric vehicles are terrible. The technology is no good. The cars are no good. You can't drive far, like Trump likes to say. This is an indictment of electric vehicles in general. I think that is also the wrong interpretation. I think that this has very little to do with Elon Musk and with electric vehicles as the problem, and everything to do with how comparatively Tesla is starting to not have the very obvious first mover advantage that it once did. It is still the case that with few exceptions, when it comes to range, Tesla is at the top when it comes to electric vehicles, although increasingly, and especially with 2025 model years, there will be lots of good competition in terms of vehicle range. That's not good for Tesla, but Tesla vehicles still have great range. When it comes to the charging network, Tesla still has the best charging network. Some other companies are being given access to it. Rivian vehicles, for example, I believe now can start using Tesla superchargers. But it is still the case that Tesla, as far as charging for longer trips, is the most convenient rather than dealing with level two chargers, which can take 7 hours to fill up the battery in a significant manner. You've got Tesla superchargers, 15, 20 minutes and off you go. The issue here is that as more people realize that for 95% of their driving, they don't need superchargers. You can just charge at home because you're not driving far enough that you're exceeding the range of the vehicle. As people realize, I actually don't need the Tesla supercharger network except for long road trips, which most people don't do. And as people realize that the build quality of Teslas, in my opinion, still leaves a little something to be desired, and there are legacy automakers that have been making cars for much longer that make really good cars. I have friends now who regularly say to me, sir, I test drove a Tesla and a Hyundai Ioniq, and I like the Ioniq better. It felt more solid, and I like the service availability of Hyundai dealerships or whatever the case may be. At the higher end, so many people that say to me, you know, I test drove the Model X.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
After 7 months, that's it. We are all waiting for death, one by one. We don't know when and how. Children like these, the majority of them are children. We pull them out and we can't tell them apart. We don't know who is left under the rubble.
As warplanes continue to bomb Gaza and the death toll nears 34,000, we go to Cairo, Egypt, to speak with a Palestinian photographer who left Gaza 10 days ago with his family. Then a picture by a Palestinian photojournalist in Gaza wins the 2024 World Press Photo of the Year. We look at the Gaza Collective Photo Essay Project.
Palestinian photojournalists are the only ones, are the only window into the suffering of people in Gaza. And so it was really important for us to go to them and to try to share and elevate again the incredible, tragic testimonies that they are reporting and covering day in, day out for the last 6 months.
And the internationally renowned feminist Palestinian professor, Nadra Shalhoub Kevorkian, reinstated by Hebrew University, is arrested by Israeli police in her Jerusalem home. We'll get the latest. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel launched a drone attack on Iran, according to Israeli and Iranian sources. Tehran said the strike hit a military airbase near the city of Isfahan, where explosions could be heard. The damage was reportedly minimal, and Iranian forces later downed 3 Israeli drones. The attack early this morning came in response to Iran's recent drone and missile attack on Israel. It comes less than 3 weeks after Israel attacked an Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, killing many people, including senior military officials. About a dozen people were killed. There were early reports of possible strikes inside Syria and Iraq as well, but those have not been confirmed. Earlier Thursday, the U.S. announced new sanctions on Iran targeting its missile and drone programs and various military entities and individuals. The EU and the U.K. are also imposing new sanctions against Iran. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at a G7 meeting in Italy earlier today, the U.S. was not involved in any offensive operation by Israel, though it's reported the U.S. received advance notice of the Israeli attack on Iran. Here in New York, riot police moved in on a peaceful student protest encampment, arresting at least 108 people at Columbia. Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq called the NYPD to clear the Gaza Solidarity encampment on the campus's South Lawn, where Columbia and Barnard students had set up one day earlier to demand university leadership divest from Israel. New York Police Chief John Schell said Shafiq identified the demonstration as a clear and present danger danger, but that officers found the students to be peaceful and cooperative. Shafiq warned all students participating in the encampment would be suspended if arrested. At least three suspensions of Barnard students were confirmed Thursday, including Isra Hirsi, daughter of Congressmember Ilhan Omar. Columbia students and faculty members held a news conference Thursday evening. This is Palestinian-American graduate student Leila Saliba, who lost 14 family members in Gaza since October 7th.
Today was a dark day for freedom of speech on Columbia's campus, because Columbia is showing that if you do not say, if you say something or do something that the university does not agree with, that they are willing to use violence towards you, and that they are willing to endanger